Good evening, everybody. We are back to our second of two perm installments of our Dessler and Psychology series. Hopefully tonight we can get in the right mindset of what perm is all about, properly preparing ourselves for the big day. They tell a story about a man in tremendous financial desperation who somehow is granted the privilege to speak to the Almighty himself. And this man appears before God and he says, "God, look, for you the entire universe is like a speck of dust. Is that right?" And God says, "Yes, it is." That's how God sounds, by the way. And he says, "And for you, a million years is like just a single second." And God says, "That's right. Yes, it is." And the man says, "And for you, $1 million is like a little penny." And God says, "Yes, it is." So the man says, I beg of you, please, could you please just give me a penny?" And God says, "Sure, in just a second." Intellectually, we know that God is infinite, that God is bigger and wider than we could ever possibly see. And yet it's hard for us because Hashem is so vast and so omnipotent and omnipresent. And for us, we're seeing such a small sliver of life. That's often where the frustrations come from, that we're not seeing the whole picture. Hopefully tonight, to use Purim as a lens, as well as the current Parshios, to talk about what it means to widen our perspective, both in terms of Hashem and other people, how so many times the frustrations that we have both in Adon Lamakom and also in Adon L'Chaveiro really stem from the fact that we're not seeing the whole picture. We're not seeing all that Hashem is doing. We're not seeing all that this person represents. And that leads us to get angry. It leads us to be confused. And if perhaps we can just see how much we cannot see, just noting the existence of the fact that God is so infinite and so wide, maybe we'll understand why it is so many times we don't understand. So tonight's essay comes from Volume 1 of Michtav Me'Eliyahu, on page 76, so just two pages tonight. And Rav Dessler is in the middle of an essay about Emunas Chachamim, where he talks about how sometimes we have doubts about our great Torah leaders, and the essay really focuses on the importance of maintaining faith that our great leaders know what they're doing, and they're running through, and then they're operating through Chachmas HaTorah. And in the process of that discussion, he quotes a beautiful idea about Purim, which we're going to read tonight. On the second paragraph, he quotes an idea that he heard from his father in the name of the Altar of Kelm, one of the great students of Rabbi Yisrael Salanter. We mentioned in the very, very beginning of the series how Rav Dessler was a direct descendant of Rabbi Yisrael Salanter, both in terms of biology, I think it was his great-grandfather, and also in terms of study. His father studied in Kelm. So the Altar of Kelm was a student of the Rabbi Yisrael Salanter, had a big impact on Rav Dessler's upbringing. So here he quotes the following idea to understand just how often we lose perspective. You know, we read Megillas Esther in about 35, 40 minutes, or depending where you are. Maybe it's 30 minutes, maybe it's 60 minutes, depending on which minyan you're at and how fast they go. But sometime in less than an hour, we're hearing an entire story. Consider the following. Though we read the story as one consecutive event, where it's underlined, Megillas Esther hi rishimas ma'asim shel teisha shanim. Did you know that the story of Purim takes place over the course of 9 years? The Megillah actually gives us the dates of the events of the king's rulership, which frames this for us. Mishnah shalosh l'malchus achashverosh, the psukim at the beginning of the Megillah tell us that the party took place in the third year of his reign. Ad shenas yed beis. The story goes on that in year 7, he finds Esther, and in year 12, Haman is casting those lots to make the gzera. And then it's 11 months later, Haman makes the lots in Nisan for the following Adar. And then the whole story speeds up and takes place over a couple days around Pesach time. Yedalot, Tesvav, Tezayin, Nisan, those are the 3 days of Esther and Mordechai's fast. And then a full 11 and a half months later, Adar, 13 Adar comes along, and that's the day when things turn upside down. The Purim story really takes place over the course of more than 9 years. Anu v'gam gedolam mimenu, us and people greater than us. Lo ayinu mavchinim b'shem ofen sha'kol inyan echad. If we were living through the story, it's possible we might not have realized the connection between the events that are going on and are organized so nicely and neatly into chapters. We might not have realized that they were connected events. V'rak Mordechai uv'tzeref ruach hakodesh b'madrega shalom. Mordechai and his level of prophecy, Yadak Yaakol Inyanecha, Mordechai, when he and Esther wrote the book down, they connected the events together. How does the story start out? L'mishta shalach Ahasuerus asur lehem Mordechai leleches. Chazal tell us that Mordechai told the Jewish people they were not permitted to go to the party that Ahasuerus was throwing. K'mefurash b'medrash Megillas Esther. Uvemalos hayamim ha'ela amr lehem al telchu. The Medrash says, when those days came, Mordechai had been warning, putting out pashkevilin, putting out cherems, throwing rocks, probably not, but those cars that go down Meir Sharim, yelling all kinds of things. Mordechai was screaming against that. He was saying, don't go! Kidei shelo yehei l'satan pischom pa'al lechem. This was Klal Yisrael's first experience being kicked out of Eretz Yisrael between Bias 1 and Bias 2. They were in a state of churban, a state of galus. And Mordechai says, don't go to this party, it'll be non-kosher food, even if there is kosher food, it's dam yenam, and you're mingling with the goyim, it's not an appropriate response for us as we're awaiting to return back to Eretz Yisrael. V'loek shivilov, Medrash says, the people didn't listen. And he references V'ayin Megillah Daf Yud Beis, the Gemara says, that is perhaps the reason why all the Jewish people were guilty of being destroyed. And the people responded back to Mordechai, we have to go. V'hayu harbe to Adam negdo. The Jewish people defended themselves and said to Mordechai, hari pikuach nefeshu. They rationalized that they had to go in order for public relations reasons that could lead to a life and death issue. Ki melech tipesh ka'ach Ahasuerus, a foolish and whimsical king like Ahasuerus, yaharo chas v'shalom es kol Yisrael beroso shekol ha'amim ba'al liyom simchaso. If he sees all the other nations come to his party, Chag Gimel Shana Malchuso, celebrating his third anniversary of his kingship, Umi Yisrael Lo Yavo Af Echad, and if he sees no Jews come, the Jewish people had a rationale. B'Al Kein Lo Shamu L'Kolo. The Jewish people did not listen to Mordechai's warning. He was the leader at the time, and he said, "Don't go to that party," and they went anyway. B'Halchu. Umi Kol Makom Lo Karo Lehem Achar Kach Davara. And you know, they went against the rabbi, they went against the psak, and you know what happens to them? They had a great time. They had drinks, they had kosher food, they had entertainment. You know, Vashi got to play hangman, right? Things got to go very interesting. They had a great time at the party. And despite all of Mordechai's warnings, you know what bad things happened to them the next day, or the next week, or the next year, or the next 5 years? Nothing. It's only Achar Tes Shanim. In year number 12, the Megillah tells us the dates. Kishon is Gadel, Haman. When Haman rises to power, and now Haman makes his decree, everyone has to bow down. The reality is, the Gemara in Sanhedrin, I believe that's what the footnote is pointing to, talks about that Haman really wasn't an Avodah Zarah, and maybe even they say Haman maybe had a statue around his neck, that wasn't really Avodah Zarah either. Mordechai wasn't really refusing to bow because it was true bona fide Avodah Zarah, but Mordechai felt it wasn't appropriate for the Jewish leader, the Jewish rabbi, to bow down to this man. Mordechai refused to bow down. And now everyone turns on Mordechai. He who turned on them 9 years earlier and said, don't go to the party, and they went, and nothing bad happens. Now the opposite happens. They turn on him. Hayu harbe mi Yisrael, where it's underlined. Hayu harbe mi Yisrael tzo'akim. People started screaming at Mordechai. Shemamid besakhanas nefasho, says Klal Yisrael. They're saying, Mordechai, you're putting us all in grave danger. Literally, grave danger. Mishum chasidus pratis yisera, because of some extra midah, it's not really Avodah Zarah you have to give up your life for, but you're taking a stand on this issue. And he quotes from another Medrash, K'mefurash b'Agadas Esther. What does the Medrash say? It's a conversation, this time, the Jewish people warning Mordechai. Aber Yisrael, the Jewish people said to Mordechai, Te'yodeya sha'ata ma'pileinu b'cherav shel zehar rasha, you're putting us at risk of being annihilated by this evil guy. Amr Lehem, Mordechai responds, I'm Cain, Ishtachav el Avodah Zarah, should I violate my principles? V'lo kibul alav. And Mordechai doesn't listen to them. And they scream at him, what are you doing to us? And then you know what happens? V'yachar zeh, kara mamish k'chol asher pachadu hacholkim ha-Mordechai mikodim. All the horrors that Mordechai warned them would happen if they went to the party and didn't happen after they went to the party. And they warned Mordechai, don't you dare challenge this guy and take a stand because who knows what's going to happen to us. All of a sudden, Mordechai doesn't bow, and that's the impetus. Hainu shiyatzas agiziras Haman lahashvedes kol Yehudim. We're looking at this story now in retrospect, with all the events tied together. Rav Dessler asked the million-dollar question. Ilu hayinu sham, if we were living through the story in real time, mahayinu omer manachnu, which side would we have been on? Would we have actually been on Mordechai's side? Ma garmel agzira, if you were living through those events, what would you have thought was the reason why we were deserving or at risk of being annihilated? Ha'im ma she'hekel Mordechai be'inyan klal Yisrael? Is it because Mordechai was light and not taking seriously Jewish lives? Or that nearly a decade earlier, that people didn't listen to Mordechai and went to the party anyway. Look at the rationale. 9 years earlier, they rationalized, we have to go to the party or we're going to be setting ourselves up for angering these nations. They go to the party against Mordechai's psak, and nothing bad happens to them. 9 years later, they warn Mordechai, don't you dare resist and antagonize this person, because we're going to be all put at risk. And Mordechai doesn't listen. He doesn't bow down. And the next thing you know, they're actually at risk. If we were there living in the story in real time, we would have taken the side. We would have said, Shanira Bechush, to our eyes, it appears, Shemasa Mordechai Garam, Shekaz Haman. It looks like Mordechai is to blame for Haman's anger. The Gazaras Hashmadas Kol Yehudim, and for the risk of annihilation for all the Jews. How do you argue with what you're seeing? We have this event that happened. Who remembers what happened yesterday? Can you remember what happened 9 years ago? Looking back at your high school days, or looking back at your college days, or looking back before you moved over here, you're looking back 9 years earlier, and you think there's a connection between what happened 9 years ago and today? But what we do see is right after Mordechai refuses to bow to Haman, there's a gzeira against the Jews. It looks like Mordechai is to blame. Not the Jews who were in violation of the gzeira to go to the party. Chazal say that's not what happened. That which appeared obvious to anyone with eyes, to our senses. The Satan, our sense of fear and our sense of how we try to put events together, it looks like, very obviously looks like, it's Mordechai's fault and not the Jewish people's fault. Mordechai is the bad guy. He's the one raising concern. We know from Chazal, it was in violation of Mordechai's takana that HaKadosh Baruch Hu allowed Haman's gzera to rise up. In terms of proximity and timing, it looked like it was Mordechai's fault. But really, it's possible it was Mordechai who took a stand against Haman, who didn't give in, who was actually our Melech Yosher, for us all assimilating, and exposed Achashverosh's hatred for the Jewish people. Maybe that was actually the saving part. And the people living through it in real time, with their narrow perspective, all they can see is that Mordechai is the one causing them problems, and the Jewish people, nothing bad happened. We'll go to the next page, page 77. It's the Yetzer Hara that dances around telling people to follow what they see with their eyes and tricks them. And that's why terrible things are really going to happen. And that's the setup for the story. To the simple viewer, to those who are living through it, it looks like it's all Mordechai's fault. When Chazal tell us it's the opposite. If it wasn't for Mordechai withstanding the Shas Hashmad and standing up to this attempt to have us all assimilate, maybe we wouldn't have been saved at all. And we're only at risk because 9 years earlier, they went to the party they weren't supposed to go to, but no one in real time connects them. We read the story, parak to parak, it looks like there's a connection. Yeah, you can see. They go to the party, Vashti is killed, Esther takes over, that's the setup to have Esther in place, Haman rises to power, and then there's a gzera against us, and Mordechai is the hero, and Esther is the hero, and they go in, and Haman has his downfall, and we're all rescued, and then there's a repealing of the decree, and then we kill all the enemies, and we have Parah Mishlach Manos Ishtari Ehu. What a fantastic story. Yeah, in hindsight, looking at the big picture, if we were living through this story, we may have been really angry at Mordechai. He's the villain! Mordechai is the villain! That's what it looks like. Mordechai is the bad guy. And then things turn around, and people start to join Mordechai's side. Amnam achar kach shavu mimachshavosem v'hodu ala emes. People start to do tshuva when they reckon, and Mordechai cries out, and he puts on sackcloth, and he gathers everyone together. V'tachas asher hayu cholam la'amo b'datam hara'a. The people could have been. Mordechai, you're calling us to pray? You're calling us to be forgiven? It's your fault! You put us in this terrible predicament. But the people actually do sincere tshuva, where they actually stop and are humble enough to recognize their own mistakes and to stop blaming Mordechai for what looks like in proximity the cause of their problems. And they could have continued to see him as a traitor and taken revenge against him. When When Mordechai declares a day of fasting and day of teshuvah, they all gather around. They know Esther is Mordechai's relative. Again, things look very sneaky. Things look terrible. Esther is getting close to Haman. This is the one shining light that we have. We have a Jewish queen in the palace, and she starts butting it up with Haman, inviting Haman to her personal party. That looks bad for us. People could have doubted Esther too. Whose side is Esther really on? They could have said, this Mordechai is the worst guy. It's his refusal to bow to Haman, which isn't really a vote of Zara anyway, that we're at risk. His cousin Esther, who's supposed to help us out, is inviting Haman to all these parties. We're doomed. We hate these people. They could have said that. But this was a turning point where the Jewish people did teshuvah. Avalheim kisheshavu teshuvah shlema. The Jewish people turned it around. Lo shamu ol v'yetzahara. They stopped believing the farce. And they agree to fast and do tshuva. And when they decide, even though it doesn't look to us that it's our fault, that party didn't seem to have any negative consequences. But if Mordechai is telling us, Baruch HaKodesh, our Navi is telling us that this really is the problem, we'll do tshuva. Az niya ha-nes, then the nes takes place, va'az nitzolu, and then they're actually able to be saved. Dessler is telling us, with this beautiful perspective, how the illusion of cause and effect that we see, or the limited scope of what we're able to understand about what's happening in the world, can often throw us for a loop, can often put us in a very bad position, where we end up vindicating those who are doing the wrong thing, and to blame those who are the ones actually saving us. It was the Jewish people who put them at risk in Shemayim. Haman has no power to kill all the Jewish people unless HaKadosh Baruch Hu is allowing him to do so. And HaKadosh Baruch Hu wasn't allowing him to do so because Mordechai wasn't bowing down. He's the hero in retrospect. HaKadosh Baruch Hu was blaming the people for going to that party and intermingling and falling into Galus and losing a step toward Geula. But HaKadosh Baruch Hu specifically planted it in a way where it's hard for us to see. The Hester Potem that's so evident throughout the Purim story is a reminder of how bad a job we do at understanding the events. Rosh Hashiva in Shalavim, Rabbi Yechezkel Yaakovson pointed out, to some extent we acknowledge we have a terrible ability to do foresight. We know we're not good at Nevi'im, we're not good at predicting the future. But to some extent we like to think that we're good at predicting the past or making sense of the past. And the example that he used is so poignant. He says, if you look at the end of Sefer Bereishis, when Yosef tells his brothers, don't feel bad that you sold me over here. You had evil intention, but HaKadosh Baruch Hu put it together, and God put me here, Yosef says, so I could sustain you during these years of famine. In hindsight, all that made sense. During the years of struggling and slavery and jail, Yosef didn't know what was going on. But in hindsight, Yosef made sense of it. You know why I'm here, Yosef said? Because to feed you during these 7 years. How wrong he was. Even in hindsight, he had a tiny sliver of the picture. Yes, it was necessary for his family's survival. But in real hindsight, we can see he was part of Bris Ben Absarim, Geula. Forming into a nation, Yitzias Mitzrayim, Kabbalah Satorah, going to Eretz Yisrael, back as a nation, as slaves, more sensitive. There's a whole story here, the Makos and Kriyas Yamsuf. Even Yosef's hindsight, Rabbi Yaakovson pointed out, is so limited. We're all quick to acknowledge we don't have foresight. But even our hindsight isn't often 20/20. When we look at the Megillah, even the people living through the story, and they can say, oh, this is why this is happening. It's very hard for a person to truly feel like they know what's going on. Because we see a sliver of time for HaKadosh Baruch Hu every a million years is a single second. I once heard, I forgot where I heard this, if someone knows the source of this vort, I would love to know. But the Mishnah Maseches Megillah in Paskin and Shulchan Aruch says, HaKore l'mafreya lo yatza, a person who reads the Megillah out of order is not yotzei his obligation. You can't read the Megillah out of order, even if you end up reading every single word. And the Mishnah Berurah adds there, in Tafresh Tzadi, Mishnah Berurah says, even if one word is out of order, you aren't yotzei your obligation. You read every single word, but just one word is out of order. Hashkafically, if you don't read the Megillah from beginning to end, if you don't read the story in order, you're missing something. The story needs to be understood in the context of the larger picture. Because to live through it in real time didn't make any sense to the people. that we're totally on the wrong side of history. And Rav Das was pointing out, we may have been on the wrong side of history too, if we had been living through it. And even in hindsight, it's hard for us to fully grasp what the plan was. But certainly, if we don't read it in order, if we don't get the complete order of what's happening, we can't be yotze. The story has to be understood in its proper context. Bob, did I see you raise a hand?
Yeah, Rabbi, I'm not sure I hear what you're saying, how we bring this to the present. It mentions in there that Mordechai had Ruach HaKodesh. We don't have that today. Is this an argument for Das Torah, that rabbinical leaders somehow have political acumen that the rest of us don't have? I mean, how do we lobby? How do we advocate for legislation for leaders in attempt to protect us? We have to do our due diligence. We have to make these decisions. We don't have Mordechai. We don't have Ruach HaKodesh. What are we supposed to do today, living in present time? We have to make decisions.
What a fantastic point. Rav Dessler, in the context of this essay that he's writing, he is putting an advocacy for Das Torah. That is really his theme, though I wouldn't necessarily subject that Rav Dessler's, 70 years ago, his version of Das Torah may not be exactly the same as that term is sometimes used today. To your point, that Mordechai was operating through Ruach HaKodesh, so he was able to see in a way that we're not, you're right. We have to do our shtadlus, and we have to operate with the facts, both from religious guidance and also tactical guidance based on what we see in front of us. The main point I want to draw out from this essay is not necessarily about Das Torah or to what extent you have Das Torah or using Das Torah to pass on medical issues. I would like to stay clear of that issue in particular and instead just focus on the idea of what it means for us to use the Purim story as an example of just how often we don't have a full perspective and how often we make judgments against Hashem and we complain about the things that are going on and we look up to Shemayim and we say, it's not fair. Why can't I just have that penny? And Hashem says, in a second. Meaning, if you had my view of the world, if you understood everything I see, it might make sense to you. So you're making a good point. I'm not weighing in this particular shir about the value or the role or the limits or the extent of Das Torah for making policy decisions going forward, but to use the Purim story as a source of emunah. For us, when things happen in life, instead of throwing up our hands and saying to Hashem, it looks like good decisions are leading to bad things, or it looks like the righteous are suffering. And Moshe Rabbeinu, in next week's parsha, asks, Hodieni nas derachacha, Hashem, teach me your ways. And the Gemara in Brachos Daf Zayin says Moshe was asking the age-old question, Tzadik v'ralo, Rasha v'tovlo. How could it be we see people who are doing the right thing, we see the Mordechais of the world who are seemingly having harm come as a result, to Rasha v'tovlo, we seemingly see people who are violating decrees, violating the halacha, and nothing bad seems to happen to them. That's Moshe's question. The Gemara has a debate whether Moshe was answered, he wasn't answered, to what extent he was answered. But the Chafetz Chaim in next week's parsha has a beautiful mashal, which I think people in Shul will appreciate. The Chafetz Chaim, former Gabbayim or current Gabbayim, will really appreciate this. The Chafetz Chaim gives a mashal of a person who's a guest in another Shul. The person walks into Shul, and he's observing at Shabbos morning how the Gabbai operates. And he notices that this person, who is getting Kohen, doesn't appear to be so learned, doesn't appear to be so special, and the person getting Hagbah doesn't look so strong. And people from that corner of the room are getting all the kibbutim, and no one from that corner of the room is getting any kibbutim. And the person who daven musaf is kind of nasally, whereas the guy next to him, this guest here, is a beautiful voice. No one asks him to daven musaf. And after daven, he goes over to the Gabbai and he says, I have so many questions. Why did you give him Kohen, and why did you give that person Hagba, and why did you only give kibbutim to that side of the room, and why was he davening musaf, and why was this guy left out? And the Gabbai responds, hi, welcome to our shul. Your complaints are making you fit right in, by the way. And he says, you've been here for one Shabbos. You don't know what's going on. Don't you realize he's the only Kohen in the room? You don't know that. This person who's doing Hagba actually bought it because he feels it's a special kibbut. That person who you think has a nice voice, he actually is not feeling so well, and he asked not to be able to stand for so long. And the person who's out in Musaf has a yahrzeit today. You don't know. People on that side of the room got kibbutim last week or last month. You can't come into a shul, observe a tiny sliver of the operation and say, why are you doing it like this and why are you doing it like that? Those who have a wider scope and know what's going on, hopefully, and Gabbayim can't be as fair as a Kadosh Baruch Hu, though it's a nice standard to live up to. But you can't come in with a little sliver of information and judge and say, why is it fair? Why is he getting this? Why isn't he getting that? We come into the world, we live maybe 70, 80, 90 years out of 6,000 years. And again, we're talking about hundreds of thousands collective, hundreds of thousands and millions of collective years of people's lives stacked on top of each other. And we come in and we say, why is this fair? Why is this happening? Why is that person suffering? And why is that person not getting rewarded? And why are they not getting any kavod? And why is this person left out of the picture? Hashem says, welcome to my world. You're experiencing 70, 80, 90 years of collective millions of years, for me, which is a second, but you're seeing a tiny scrap of the picture. And you have all these questions, and I get it. If you're only here for one Shabbos, you have a lot of questions. If you're only here for one fraction of the course of history, you have a lot of questions. Tzadik v'ra'ala, Rasha v'tovlo. The answer is, Zuchas Avos plays a role, and previous merit this person did, and Olam Haba, and Olam Hazeh, and all kinds of things, of people's interlocking zechuyos, and one person is supporting someone else, and you never know the person's hidden zechuyos. Millions of things are happening at the same time, and we're looking at a tiny fraction, and we're saying, explain it to me. Explain it all to me. Tell me how, why it makes sense. We are seeing a tiny sliver of human history. We're not good at seeing, predicting how things are going to go. We're not even good at looking back and saying, that's why that happened. Yosef thought he understood, but even he was looking at a narrow lens of just 22 years. We zoom out for 210 years and we see there was an even bigger story going on. And we go out even another concentric circle and there's another story going on. Who of us can really claim to know why things happen? Who of us can really claim to know why a person is being treated a certain way? We don't understand why we're getting, why we're not getting that penny from Hashem, because we're not really understanding the full second. We're not really seeing the full course of history at once, like a Kadosh Baruch was able to see all of history at once. And if that's the perspective he has, then we can understand why things may not be clear to us. And so our first takeaway for tonight is Purim is the perfect time. As we look at the story, which takes place over 9 years, but in real time was probably very hard to understand, to recognize just how limited we are and to see how much we do not see as a way of recognizing when Hashem is hidden, as an opportunity for us to slow ourselves down, to table some of our questions, to relax some of our tainas against Hashem, to lower our voice and to have emunah. Purim is that time where we recognize HaKadosh Baruch Hu is hidden and he's seeing things that we're not seeing. Our first takeaway for tonight. Any thoughts before we move to our second takeaway?
I would have thought the story of Yosef would be and his brothers, and that occurred over 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of an illustration of this sort of example of a longer time period, and then what you brought up, obviously Yosef didn't realize that the brothers didn't acknowledge that there was, they didn't think anything of it. Yosef realized that there was a bigger play here that was going on, and that guy was obviously, he didn't know all the way, back to Abraham's time, but he acknowledged that he was just a pawn in this
mm-hmm.
thing.
Yosef had a wider lens than his brothers,
right?
But then we have a wider lens than Yosef.
The whole story occurred over 20 years. That could have been,
20 years feels like a long time to us. So for us, it feels like we're seeing with proper perspective.
But
this is 9 years in the Purim story, right? But I think the point is that even 20 years, even 9 years, doesn't always give us the full picture. People living through the story, even if they think they're using hindsight, they may not fully understand what's going on.
Right, I'm saying in Yosef's case, it's 20 years.
It's even longer. And even so, he didn't have the full story.
Right.
Just goes to show. If this is the way that we can ease some of our frustration with HaKadosh Baruch Hu, when we get confused or we get angry, to stop and just acknowledge that we are not seeing the whole picture. We can use the same strategy with each other. We often get angry at people because of the way that they slight us or how they behave. And we can use the exact same perspective of realizing we're seeing a sliver of an entire entity. The Parshas Tetzaveh this week is talking about Big Day Kahuna. And the Gemara Maseches Arachin, Daf Tezayin, says each of the Big Day Kahuna was mechaper, atoned for a very specific, very serious sin. And the Akedas Yitzchak, Rabbi Yitzchak Arama, in the 1400s, writes that it's not just a heebie-jeebie magic thing. The Kohen Gadol wears the me'il and it's mechaper. It's that by looking at that particular garment and the lesson that it teaches us, if we learn that lesson, that is the kapara for the particular sin. Just to give one example, the Gemara says that the me'il, the long, sleeveless blue tunic that the Kohen Gadol would wear, which had bells and pomegranates on the bottom, was an atonement for Lashon Hara. Why? Because the bells are very noisy. So a person makes a lot of noise, Lashon Hara, spreads rumors and posts things on Facebook and Twitter and says a lot of nasty stuff. The bells of the Me'il say, ding, 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 loud noise, it's not appropriate. Work on yourself. Then the question is, well, it doesn't only have bells, it also has pomegranates. So if the Me'il is supposed to be teaching us not to speak Lashon Hara, the bells are about making a lot of noise, but what did the pomegranates teach us? I heard from Rabbi Rasner, he quoted Rabbi Isaac Bernstein, Zecher Tzadik Livracha, who says that Lashon Hara really stems from a failure to understand the proper chashivas, importance that we have to give each person. The pomegranate represents that. Because the Gemara in Erev and Adaf Yates says that even the emptiest Jewish person in the world is full of mitzvos like a pomegranate. A pomegranate is full of seeds. Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky pointed out, the pomegranate is one of those fruits you really can't tell what it's going to be like by looking at the outside. An apple peel or an orange peel or a banana peel, an avocado, you look at a fruit from the outside, you can normally get a sense if it's brown, if it's mushy, if it's decaying, if it's drying out. Normally you can get a sense from the outside, judge a fruit by its cover, you can get a sense of how it tastes. A pomegranate, Rav Yaakov pointed out, even if the rind, even if the shell is faded, the seeds inside don't necessarily go based on that outside. And therefore we're looking at a coarse human being. We're looking at a person and we're saying, feh, this person's obnoxious. This person is selfish. This person is mean. This person is rude. This person is uncaring. This person is not taking davening seriously. This person doesn't care about mitzvos. They're stingy. We ring our bell. And after every bell on the me'il comes a pomegranate to say, beneath that rough exterior, this tiny sliver which you're judging the entire fruit based on, there might be an entire world of beautiful, delicious, luscious, tasty seeds inside. Sweet, sweet mitzvahs the person does that you have no idea about. You're quick to label this person empty and define the entire person by the bad actions that you see. That leads to Lashon Hara. Lashon Hara is often very black and white. We don't speak Lashon Hara like, look, I understand this person has a whole context and they had a bad childhood, and we just say the person's obnoxious, they're rude, they're uncaring, they're stingy. There's a whole world to this person. There's a whole depth and sweetness beneath the exterior that we're not seeing. And the me'il, if it's going to be mechaper, it's going to change our mindset to help us overcome Lashon Hara, it's going to be by teaching us, when you think of ringing your bell and making a lot of noise, stop and ask yourself, how much of this person am I really seeing? In social psychology, this term is known as the fundamental attribution error. Fundamental attribution error. We make an error when we look at someone else's behavior, and we use that single incident to conclude about the person's character and in a self-defining way label the person as nasty or selfish or obnoxious. They did a study where I showed people videos of strangers. Strangers cutting in line, strangers cutting people off, strangers walking into a store and not paying, strange stories of people bumping into people or people texting while they're walking. And they asked people, look at these strangers in the video, what conclusions can you make about them? Or they asked people, not just videos, but in real time. They had actors run through a line or cut or do something that seemingly was obnoxious. And they asked observers, either live or on video, what do you think about this person? They would say, he's obnoxious, he's arrogant, if he wasn't giving charity, he was stingy. They tended to make judgments, not just about the action, but they attributed to the fundamental nature of the person, he is stingy, she is selfish, he is careless, she is clumsy. But they showed people back their own actions. And they said, what would you say if I showed you cutting in line one time? Oh, that was different. I was really tired this day and I really had to go quickly and I only had a couple of items and the person behind me was taking too long. And when we do something, there's a context for it. We know ourselves. We know our mood. We know our history. We know where we're going. We know what has to be done. So we give ourselves context and we say, I may have done the wrong thing. I feel bad that I was impatient or I feel bad that I wasn't sensitive, but I'm not an obnoxious person. I didn't give charity that time because the kids were screaming upstairs and I couldn't give the person the dollar. I couldn't find my wallet and people were yelling from the bathroom upstairs. I just didn't have a moment. I know the context of my life. I see the entirety of it. So I can say, I can label the action or I can give myself context. But for a stranger, if all I'm looking at is this sliver, I can say, they must be obnoxious. They must be terrible. They must be stingy and rude. And the reality is, even if it's not strangers, even if it's people that we've known for a long time, we tend to make the same mistakes. We tend to judge them based on one time they rebuffed us, or didn't invite us back, or didn't invite us in the first place to something. He's ungrateful, she's uncaring. We don't just label the action and try to give it a context. We just say, this person is off the Christmas list, or whatever, off the Shalchmanas list, right? Because they're naughty. They don't belong in this, because they're rude. We're unforgiving. We're quick to not notice the delicious seeds that are underneath. In the first parak of Pirkei Avos, Mishnah says, "Havidan es kol ha'adam l'kaf s'chus," simply translated as, judge each person, judge everyone, dan l'kaf s'chus, fairly. But the Sfas Emes points out that "Havidan es kol adam" would have meant all people. What does it mean, "Havidan es kol ha'adam"? It doesn't mean judge all people. It means judge the whole person. I grew up with a lot of books that did a great job coming up with Dan Lechav Schus stories. There, it was the person's twin, or the cat came. Those stories are fine. And once in a while, we do tend to judge based on things that we can't possibly know. But the best kind of Dan Lechav Schus stories are not the ones where we have to make up far-fetched, totally aliens came in and switched the person for a clone. The best kind of Dan Lechav Schus is to say, I'm not seeing the whole person. I can't judge based on what I'm seeing now. Because I know if I was doing something, I wouldn't want to be judged in my entire character and my entire family and my entire history by one thing that I did wrong or one thing that doesn't seem to be representative of who I am. Later in Perek Beis of Pirkei Avos, Al tadin es chavercha ad shetagi lemakomo. Do not judge your friend until you come to his place. Simply translated, it means don't judge a person until you walk a mile in their shoes. I like to say, and then you can judge them. What are they going to do? You're a mile away and you have their shoes. Well, they're not going to come after you or anything, right? So fine. But the Sfas Emes again pointed out, Al tadin es chavercha, don't judge someone else, ad shetagi lemakomo, until you can come to his exact place. Sfas Emes says what Hillel's really saying there is, you can't properly judge any person, because you could never come to his exact place. What do you mean? I was also poor, and I wasn't obnoxious. I was also poor, and I wasn't stingy. Do you have their upbringing? Do you have their temperament? Do you have their IQ? Do you have their siblings and their spouse and their family? And there's so many factors that make us who we are. And we know that. We know how complicated and sophisticated we are. We're complicated. We have a rationale for everything. We know the context for ourselves. We see how there's an explanation or there's a context for what we do. But for others, we fundamentally attribute that which we see as self-defining. We get so frustrated when we see other people acting in ways that bother us. But just like with Hashem, we're only seeing a fraction of the picture, a fraction of their life, a fraction of what's beneath the surface, of what makes them who they are, what they've been through, any traumas that they've been through. No one has an excuse, and leave it to Hashem, who sees the whole world, to be the ultimate judge. But from our limited perspective, we don't know why he does what he does, because we're not seeing all the years that he's seeing. But we also don't even understand the tzaddik and the rasha, tzaddik varela rasha v'tovlo. We don't know who these people are. We don't really have a good sense of the people, let alone the events that are happening to them and the way Hashem runs the world. Chazal say Haman spoke the worst Lashon Hara of all. Haman said, Yeshno am, mefuzar, mufara, bena amim. There's a nation that they're so clicky and they fight with each other and they don't get along. Haman was raising a great taina against the Jewish people. There was a lot of infighting and not getting along. This Lashon Hara comes, this clickiness comes from judgment based on how someone dresses or how someone davens or how someone talks or how much they give or whether they were invited to this. Or we're so quick to judge. And Haman pointed that out. And according to the Sefer Manos HaLevi, Shlomo Alkabetz, the author of Lecha Dodi, he has a commentary on Megillas Esther. And he writes, that was the importance of Mishloach Manos Ishtarei Ehu, to counteract Haman's Lashon Hara, that we speak Lashon Hara and we're so divided and we're so quick to judge each other and make clicks based on superficial differences. We try to overcome that by specifically creating reis, by creating friendship, by creating camaraderie on Purim. That's the goal of Bishlach Manos. Matanas Le'avyonim, Sudas Purim, Mitzvos of Purim are devoted to building people up, bringing people together. So you know what we do? We give Bishlach Manos to all of our best friends, people we already like very much. And maybe sometimes we make a list that I'm not going to give that person. I gave them last year and they didn't give back to me. The whole point of Mishloach Manos is to bridge the gaps and not hold on to a grudge and not to judge people based on what they once did one time. Because we know our mistakes don't define us. So why should someone else's mistakes define them? Why should we use Mishloach Manos, which was geared toward overcoming those differences, as an opportunity to create further cliques and further chances to divide? This year, give someone you weren't going to give. And if it's me, I'll gladly take it. Give someone you weren't going to give. Give someone that you weren't planning on giving to. Either someone that you stopped giving because they didn't give back, or someone who's never home, or someone who maybe is off your radar. Give to at least one person that you weren't planning on giving, you haven't given to before, or haven't given to in a while. That's the mitzvah. To build up connections. To create friendships. To stop looking at the surface and making arbitrary divisions. That's what Haman claimed that we do. And we're not going to do that anymore. Because we understand the mitzvah of Purim is for us to realize just how much our limited vision blinds us from really seeing the full picture. Both when it comes to HaKadosh Baruch Hu and the way he runs the world, and how 9 years or 20 years or 100 years or 500 years is not enough. HaKadosh Baruch Hu is seeing collective millions of years all stacked on top of each other. People's stories and their upbringings and their temperaments. We don't know how Hashem runs the world. And it's important for us to challenge our frustration by stopping and saying, I'm limited. I don't know how much Hashem is operating with. I can't possibly know. And just seeing that I can't see everything is enough to have the emunah in Hashem and say, the Purim story teaches me how what looks to me to be an obvious cause and effect. It's Mordechai's fault. It's not the Jewish people's fault. Then Habakkuk. We don't know. We don't know. Purim is a reminder in our daily lives that Kadosh Baruch Hu runs the world. And with each other. Let's not fall prey to what Haman claimed that we're doing. That we're judging each other. And we're splitting based on arbitrary divisions. That we're fundamentally attributing poor qualities to people or defining them or writing them off because of one slight or even an ongoing slight. But what's the context here? Each person is a beautiful pomegranate. Each person is a depth to them. Each person has so much we cannot possibly see. And Mirtz Hashem, this Purim, if we use this perspective of Hester Panim, how Hashem is so hidden, how our view is so limited, both when it comes to B'nai Makom, B'nai L'Chavira, we'll be able to see just how much we cannot see in an effort to have more emunah in Hashem and more reyes with each other.